rabies in Maine. So far this year, we've seen several headline-catching rabies cases in Maine. Last month, a 95-year-old man in Brunswick killed a rabid fox with a plank. That same week, a rabid otter bit a woman at a beach in Rockland. Then, earlier this month, a man in Lisbon killed a rabid fox in his kitchen with a meat cleaver. It seems like more incidents than usual, but is it? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about rabies with two experts. We'll find out what to do if you're worried about a wild animal near you and how this year compares to others. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In movies or books, it seems, whenever an animal or human has rabies, there seems to be foaming at the mouth and crazed behavior. But as you might imagine, that is not really how it happens. We're going to talk with experts today about what rabies really is and how to spot it. We'll also learn about prevention and treatment. In the studio with me, Michelle Walsh. She is the state veterinarian with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. And Scott Lindsay is a regional wildlife biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about the cases of rabies you've heard about in the news? Do you have questions about keeping your pet or family safe from rabid wild animals? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I want to thank both of you for being here. Michelle, I'll start with you. What exactly is rabies? It affects the central nervous system, correct?
Correct. Yes, it's a virus, and it's an ancient virus, actually. Been known in the human records since before, well, as early as 4th century BC, and it is a virus that is usually communicated from mammal to mammal, inoculated, so really injected via infected saliva, goes into the nerves in the area where the bite is communicated, and then it migrates up those nerves to the spinal cord and eventually to the brain, and then it gets into the salivary glands. So that's...
And is the, you know, we hear about people being bit by a rabid animal, but is that the only way to transmit? And if a wild animal bites your dog and your dog scratches you, can you get rabies?
That would not be a way that you could get rabies from your dog. But if any way that the infected saliva, so the virus-laden saliva, gets into an open wound or a fresh wound or mucous membranes, eyes, nose, mouth, but those are... The most common way that it's transmitted is via a bite.
Okay. Scott, are there only certain kinds of animals that can carry rabies?
Well, any mammal can potentially carry rabies. There are some mammals, though, that are more likely to carry that, some that are more susceptible to it, and those include carnivores and omnivores. In Maine, our probably big four right now would be raccoon, skunk, red fox and gray fox, and bat. Now, any other mammal can, again, be infected, so all animals should be treated with the same type of precautions. But those four would probably raise the red flag if they are symptomatic.
Okay, and most of the cases we've had so far in Maine, it seems what's in the news, raccoons, skunks, foxes, right?
That is correct. But again, I point out that just recently we've also had an otter that was confirmed rabid, a bobcat as well. There have been groundhogs that have been positive. So these other animals, you know, they may not be in that group of big four, but they certainly are potential. So we should be treated similarly.
Okay. And bats, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because bats are in danger and they're in trouble. And the last thing we want to be doing right now is... killing a bat if it doesn't have rabies, but if there's a bat in your home, what do you recommend?
Yeah, the human health implications of that are going to take priority if there is a likelihood or potential that there's been exposure between a bat and a person inside a house or outside a house. So if a bat is in a house and there was known exposure, then certainly that would trigger our normal rabies response protocol. The bat would be contained, you know, be tested at our lab in Maine, and Maine CDC would follow up with the person that was exposed. If, for instance, the bat, let's say the bat is flying around and then you go into your child's room and you did not see the bat bite, there's no evidence of the bat biting anybody. In those circumstances, when it's a child or perhaps a person that may not be aware that there was contact, CDC would probably treat that as if it was an exposure, be conservative about it, and just try to contain the bat, send it in for testing, and follow up with the person for post-exposure treatment.
If you know there's no exposure, though, you shouldn't be chasing the bat around your house with a shovel. Try to open a window and get it out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you do find a bat in your room and you just go in, let's say you're going in and you're just getting the kids ready for bed and you see a bat flying around in there, it's disconcerting when that happens. It's happened to me. And the best thing to do is just to turn the lights on, open the windows, close the door, stay in the room, though. Someone has to stay in the room, it's recommended. Kind of get in a corner and just have the window open. And most of the time, you'll see that bat fly out. So you want to document that it is out of the room. But there's no need to go around and killing something just because it's in your house, no.
Michelle, it seems as though a lot of the reports we get about animals that come in contact with rabid wild animals are dogs. Are other animals... do you see reports of other animals? Do you see horses or cows or cats?
Sure. Yes, actually, we had a positive domestic cat this year. A lot of times the cats that test positive are often cats who spend quite a bit of time outside or sometimes part of a feral population, so they may not be owned and may not be vaccinated. But we do have reports of livestock exposure every year. It's fairly unusual for us in Maine to have positive livestock. I include horses in the livestock category. But we do; it does happen, and we had a positive cow last year. And as you can imagine, any animal that spends time outside and can come into contact with an infected mammal is susceptible. And a lot of our livestock are not vaccinated. So,
is the reason we see it most often in dogs just because dogs are curious and adventurous and will go up to that raccoon or skunk?
That's possible. I think also in a place like Maine, we have a lot of rural open areas where people let their dogs off leash. We probably have lots of cats off leash too, but we monitor their activities a lot less closely. But I do think dogs are sort of social, gregarious animals and are more likely to approach a wild animal who is acting abnormally or vice versa. That infected animal usually behaves abnormally. So an animal who would usually keep its distance, like a fox, keeping its distance from a dog, might actually rush that dog and become aggressive.
Mm. It seems as though we're seeing sort of clusters of places that are having attacks this year. And Brunswick, of course, comes to mind. Scott, is that indeed how this often unrolls, is that there'll be a certain community where there are a whole bunch of cases, and then other communities, I'm looking at the statistics from the state, nothing in York County.
Yes, correct. I mean, if you look at the overall data over the years compiled by CDC, rabies is occurring throughout the entire state, all counties. But if you look at specific sites, and again, those are called clusters, as you pointed out, that is something that we are probably having currently in Brunswick right now. And that is part of what rabies is. It's kind of cyclic in nature. And anytime you have animals like raccoons that actually do fairly well in close proximity to development in the people, they can actually benefit from it. You're going to have a fairly high density of them. That means that there's animals that are exposed are more likely to be in contact with other animals that are not exposed. And thus it propagates itself, which is what a virus is really designed to do. So that is something that we do see, these pulses, these clusters with high numbers. And then it seems as though as the wildlife population in that area is going to decline, since many of them do die, and rabies is fatal to many of these wildlife, I would say at that point there's less potential exposure between animals, and that incidence locally can subside. And then you may see it pick up again in another area or even in the same area again several years from now.
So what? How do I know? I'm out in my yard and I see a fox. How do I know if that fox is rabid, if that fox is just taking a stroll through my yard? What do you advise?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We get that question a lot at our office, and we're happy to answer those. Because people will see wildlife in their backyard, and sometimes if they see an animal, they assume there's got to be something wrong with it. There's a fox, there's a raccoon in my backyard. Can you please come and have it trapped and removed? The thing is, we do have a lot of wildlife in our state. Wildlife is fairly well adapted to live in fairly close proximity to us. So just because you see an animal, I would not suspect it being rabid. Even if you see an animal like a fox or a raccoon during the day, does not necessarily mean it is rabid. You're looking for other behavioral signs and symptoms of rabies. And largely, since rabies does affect the limbic system of animals, you're looking for changes in behavior. If you go up to that raccoon and fox and you're in fairly close proximity, let's say you get out of your car and you see a raccoon, normally it's going to kind of stroll away or go away. If that, instead that animal starts coming towards you, acts aggressive, behavior is just different than you would expect for a raccoon or a fox, then that is something that is going to raise a red flag. And you'll say, this is not normal for this animal. You're going to look for other signs, physical signs. Is the animal appear to be lack coordination? Is there any type of mucus coming out of its eyes, out of its mouth? Things like that. Is it extremely lethargic? There's another phase of rabies. It's not just excitatory rabies. There's a phase of rabies where the animal is very lethargic, and that is called a prodromal or dumb phase of rabies. And if you go out and see a fox just curled up, lying around in your driveway, and it's there for several hours, that's atypical for a fox to do. So that would be something that would, again, be a cause of concern, and they should contact a department.
So the presence of an animal, no, not necessarily a sign of rabies. Even a skunk during the daytime or something like that, even though we think of skunks as being out at night, they do sometimes walk around during the day.
Correct.
But if that animal is acting unusually, stay away, and would you recommend they call you?
Yes, absolutely. The thing to do is to make sure you do not come into contact with it, so keep a defensible distance from all wildlife. Again, whether it is something which is symptomatic for rabies or not, and definitely you want to alert our department. Sometimes your local ACO may be able to assist with that as well.
Animal control officer.
Animal control officers, yes. But you can certainly call our department, and we will come in and take a look.
Dr. Walsh, is an animal that's been immunized and has had the rabies vaccine, is that animal 100% protected against an attack of a rabid raccoon or a rabid skunk or something like that?
That's a great question. The rabies vaccine is one of the most effective vaccines that's out there. But no vaccine is 100%. So we do in the state of Maine regulate the administration of rabies vaccines. In other words, a licensed veterinarian needs to give a rabies vaccine. And one of the reasons for that, it's a very common regulation in a lot of states, is to make sure that it's properly administered because it is a universally fatal disease. But it's a very effective vaccine. But I would always caution people that no vaccine is 100% protective. So it's one of the reasons why when there is an encounter between a domestic animal and a rabid animal or suspected rabid animal, that we do recommend that animal see a veterinarian and be evaluated and have a booster to its rabies vaccine. And if it hasn't been vaccinated, that it should actually go into a quarantine at home, supervised, though, by the local animal control officer, ACO. And it's usually done in conjunction with a veterinarian as well.
Okay, so let's say I live in rural Maine. I have a dog. The dog has been vaccinated, but this is a dog that runs around all day long, comes back from the woods, looks like it's been a scuffle. Do you take that dog to your vet? I mean, certain kinds of dogs are kind of always getting into it.
So what our recommendation is, and we actually have a document that's available to the public called the Maine Rabies Management Guidelines. It's available at maine.gov. I can share that information with you later for your website. that actually recommends that wounds of unknown origin on our domestic pets are cause for a visit to your vet.
All right. There have been a lot of rabies cases in the news this year. That's partially why we're doing this program now. A lot of headlines. Is it an unusually busy year, or have the cases just been unusual enough to make the headlines?
So Scott and I were talking about that a little bit earlier. It's actually a pretty average year for the incidence of rabies, the numbers of rabies positive cases that we have this year. And that information is also available on the Maine.gov website. But we've had some very high profile cases, some that have been covered by the media. And I think that's why we've had a lot of interest in rabies this year. Similar to last year, you may remember, we had a couple of cases of a young woman jogger got attacked by a raccoon and ended up, the
drowning it in a puddle.
Drowned it in a puddle. Incredible. Mm-hmm. Don't mess with the Maine woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's a pretty average year. And as Scott alluded to earlier, we do see cycles with rabies that after a very mild winter, we see earlier cases and initially more reports of abnormally behaving mammals, which usually end up with the animal being tested if it's exposed to a human or a domestic animal. But it doesn't change necessarily the number of positives that we have.
Okay. And Scott, I want to ask you about kind of the history of rabies in Maine. I was surprised to find out that there was a point in our past where it wasn't here.
Yes. Rabies has been certainly in this country for quite some time. I mean, there are even records of George Washington writing in his journals about coming into contact with what he calls mad dogs, wild dogs at the time. And so that has been, they've been prevalent in this country for quite some time. Rabies in Maine, though, particularly our raccoon strain that we are seeing, seems to have really spread in the 90s and is the more recent occurrence for that. But other ones, the skunk fox, and the bat variants, those have been one that have probably been in Maine for over a century. There's been documentation of that. So it is always out there. It is endemic in our wildlife populations, and we do expect it'll likely be there for the foreseeable future. It's definitely something that we have to learn to manage and recognize, much as we do for Lyme disease, which is another zoonotic disease, which is a disease carried by wildlife that we need to be aware of.
Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We're talking about rabies today. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Mimic, celebrating 25 years of working with employers and employees to reduce workplace injuries, on the web at mimic.com. Lake Stewards of Maine, protecting Maine lakes through widespread citizen participation. Learn how you can help at lakestewardsofmaine.org. And Marshall Communications, a Maine-based public relations firm with global reach, working to connect businesses and nonprofits with their targeted audiences.
In the years since deadly protests in Charlottesville, dozens of Confederate monuments have come down. But in many cities, the fight isn't over when the statues are removed.
What would it feel like if your fifth great grandfather's grave was destroyed? Yes, it's personal.
We'll bring you to Memphis, where their statues are tied up in court, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
Hello, I'm Nina Totenberg. Whether you come for the essential news of the day, or to be inspired by intriguing new ideas, or to become more engaged with the world around you, the reasons you choose to tune into and love Maine Public Radio matter so very much. That's why your contribution today also matters, because this vital service comes with a cost, and no matter what your reason for bringing public radio into your life, your support is the key to Maine Public Radio's continued efforts to keep our community informed, enriched, and in tune with our world. Please call or go to mainepublic.org right now and make a donation that will be counted towards the Super Thursday one-day pledge drive, and thank you.
And Super Thursday is coming up this Thursday, August 2nd. You can contribute right now at mainepublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-4000. 1475.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Rabies. Joining me today, Scott Lindsay, wildlife biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Dr. Michelle Walsh, who's our state veterinarian. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And I'd like to offer a quick correction. Earlier in the program, I mentioned something about the otter incident. That was indeed, the otter was in the ocean. Correct, Scott? Yeah.
Yes.
So not on a lake. I want to go to Greg on Facebook. He says, why can't humans get a single shot preemptive rabies inoculations just like our pets do?
I guess I'll take that one, unless
okay.
you could
for it.
Chime in. So actually, there are a sector of people who are on the job exposed to rabies, like veterinarians, like veterinary technicians, animal control officers, who do often get vaccinated against rabies. It's still a series of three inoculations, just so Greg knows. Our immune systems, the way, without going into a great deal of boring detail, frankly, we often need to see something at least twice in order to build immunity against it. So we need at least two rabies vaccines, just like our pets do. But for those of us who have been vaccinated against rabies in the past, as long as we've been current on our boosters, if I'm exposed, for example, to a rabid animal, I'm bitten, I still have to get a series of two post-exposure prophylaxis, we call it. It's actually vaccinations, and instead of getting the rabies immunoglobulin, which actually really goes after that rabies vaccine if it's present, rather than relying on my antibodies, those of us who have been previously vaccinated don't need the immunoglobulin, which is the stuff that of nightmares that everybody talks about, where you get all these injections right at the site of the bite, and it's really thick, and it really hurts when they inject it because it is thick and it forces your skin apart and all this kind of just gory stuff. But anyways, sorry, Greg, there will never be just a one-shot fix.
Nick asks in an email, a few months ago, I found a dead fox in my backyard. I called animal control in my town near Portland and got an email back stating, we don't dispose of animals found on private property. Either bury it on your property or put it in your trash. I wrote back asking if they were concerned about rabies because I was. I also requested information about how to proceed safely. I got no response from my email, so I donned enough personal protective equipment to look like an astronaut and went to work bagging the animal for the trash. My town needs to respond better. Did his town do the right thing? And what's your reaction to that story?
I mean, that's true. If they called our department, we would probably respond similarly in that just because an animal dies on someone's property, there's really no protocol set up that we would go to the property to pick up and dispose of the animal. If an animal has not contacted a domestic animal or a person, then it does not go into our rabies response protocol, where we would definitely come and pick it up and make sure that it gets to the health environmental testing lab. If an animal died in someone's backyard, could have died from many different causes, or it could have died from rabies, even if it did die from rabies, we're not testing animals just in random in most situations. Most of the time, the best thing to do is just to leave it alone. Do as that person did. Use your gloves. Use a tool. Do not touch the animal. You can cover it up with some leaves. You can cover it up with some lime to hasten decomposition. And again, just make sure that nobody kind of goes around that.
That's interesting to me. So if an animal is found dead on your property, especially like a fox or a raccoon, which seem to be the most common carriers of rabies, and individuals are disposing of those animals themselves, that means our rabies count numbers are probably not accurate, right? I mean, there are probably lots of animals out there who are dying of rabies.
Absolutely.
And not being accounted for.
Yes. I mean, once an animal, wildlife, is symptomatic for rabies, I mean, it's most likely that that animal will be dead within 2 weeks. So a lot of animals probably are dying on the landscape. And so long as it has not contacted us, then if that animal remains there, if it's in a warm environment, once that animal is dead, that rabies virus will not be active. But you should exercise caution, particularly around in conditions where it's cooler. Say if at refrigerated temperatures, like during maybe late fall, winter, that is something that can prolong the activity of the rabies virus, and it can persist for longer periods of time. So just treat it as if it is rabid, and use your protective gear and just dispose of it exactly the way he did.
So this time of year, summer, if you find a dead animal, how long does it take for the rabies virus to not be active anymore, to be killed by the environment?
Well, Michelle may want to follow up on that. I understand it's fairly quickly.
Yeah, so we consider it inactive after 24 hours.
24 hours, wow.
Yes, and actually probably sooner if it's exposed to sunlight. So we consider it, we call it a weak environmental virus. It means it doesn't survive very well at all outside of the host.
Interesting. We're going to go to Lisa, who's calling from Somerset County. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, if you had an animal in your yard, asking for a friend, and they obviously looked mottled and were spinning around and didn't look healthy and had children around, is it legal to have someone other than Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, who can't always get there right away, to put it out of its misery and keep their family safe?
Yes.
We had that situation here, and we did not know what to do.
Okay.
The poor deer was also in pain.
Okay, and Lisa, you said this was a deer then that was behaving like this?
Yes.
Okay.
We didn't know if it might have been a brain thing for the deer or rabies. We just couldn't tell, but it was acting very strangely, and there were a lot of kids around.
Okay. If it is a situation where you observe that, and it is not an emergency situation, and you could at least talk over the phone with department staff, you could certainly call our dispatch for our department. And that is at 624-7022. And at least that would put you in contact with a game warden or a biologist to discuss that. If it is something that you see an animal that is in obvious distress and you have concern about either your animals or yourselves, then you can shoot that animal so long as you do contact our department shortly thereafter, usually within 24 hours. But the best thing to do is to try to make that contact to us initially.
Lisa, thanks for your call and an excellent question. We'll go to Jeff on Facebook, who's asking, is the rabies vaccine that people get still a painful series of needles injected into the stomach?
I'll take that one. I think there's a lot of lore associated with post-rabies exposure prophylaxis or treatment for humans. It's a series. I don't want anybody to quote me on this. My human health counterparts are probably cringing. But I believe it's a series of four post-exposure inoculations plus a dose or two of rabies immunoglobulin. That's the really thick stuff that used to be injected around the site of the bite, which may have been the stomach or may have been the hand or the foot or whatever, but that was the one and still is the one that actually causes quite a bit of pain. So again, I don't want anyone to quote me on exactly with a series of shots, but it's a lot less traumatic than it used to be. It's still a big deal, and it's still very expensive, often not covered by insurance. So that's something
really
to be aware
not
of.
Covered by insurance, even right. though rabies is deadly.
Correct. And my colleagues at Maine CDC, and there is a 1-800 number for not just rabies, but everything related to human disease exposure. I can give that number if that's okay. It's 1-800-821-5821, and I'm sure you'll have that information available on your website. But I would consult with a human healthcare provider who may actually connect you to that hotline to get information about the rabies post-exposure treatment.
And let me also ask you about help. Is there help available for folks who want to get a rabies vaccine for their pet and are low income?
So the state does support the low-cost rabies vaccination clinics, and those are listed actually on the Maine.gov website in the animal welfare section of the website. I can send you that link. And a lot of our local pet supply providers. So PetSmart, Petco, they will often host or advertise for local low-cost rabies vaccination clinics. Oftentimes, local fire departments also sponsor those. So keep an eye out on your town bulletin board. Probably is the best another way to find out about those. But you can always call the state animal welfare department.
Yeah, and I'd also say, Jennifer, that while we're on this subject, it has been critical that the increase in vaccination in dogs and cats, which again is legally required to vaccinate both dogs and cats now, since about the 1950s, has had significant benefits as far as containing rabies to the wildlife population, and we do not see it, you know, as prevalent in the dog and cat population as we had in the past. And as is the case in other parts of the world where it is still a very significant problem as far as dogs and cats coming into contact with humans. So vaccination is very, very important. It's part of being a responsible pet owner to make sure your pets are vaccinated.
An email from Pat. When my son was two, he touched a bat that was sitting on a log on the roadside in the middle of the day. The bat flew off. We don't know if my son was bit, but he went through the weeks of shots as a precaution. Are there any long-term effects to humans from undergoing the treatment?
I am not aware of that specifically. I cannot address that, but I do know as far as bats, I can certainly understand the conservative approach taken there of just going ahead and following through with post-exposure treatment. Because sometimes with bats, it is not often a case where it is spread by a bite that they may be aware of. Very small teeth, and the possibility for exposure is probably higher for bats than it is for other animals when you're going to be much more aware of if a raccoon is clamped onto your leg than a bat. So probably they're just going to take the safe course there and just begin the treatment, which we see with bats.
A question from Veterinarian Rehabilitation Center of Cape Elizabeth. We find that many cat owners who keep their cats indoors are resistant to getting the rabies vaccine for their cats. Would you have your guests please explain the importance of rabies vaccines even for pets who stay inside?
I'd be happy to respond to that. That's a great issue to bring up, actually. Scott is correct. Rabies is the only vaccination that the state requires by law for any animal. So, and we actually require it for cats, dogs, and ferrets, pet ferrets. The reason we require it for ferrets is because those three species are the ones that are included. The vaccine is actually approved for use in all three of those species. And people do keep pet ferrets, so why not keep them in that loop? When I was in practice, I certainly fielded a number of questions from indoor-only cat owners about why do I need to vaccinate for rabies. Number one, it's required by law. Number two, bats get in the house, and that's where your indoor cat hangs out. And guess what? Your indoor cat's probably bored, so they're probably going to be tempted to interact with that bat, especially if it's on the floor or somewhere abnormal for a bat to hang out. So they are potentially at risk for exposure. The other thing that I find with outdoor cats is they often do get out. And we think
indoor cats often get out, yes.
So, and then you want them to be protected if they do escape from your house. They're a beloved pet. And rabies, like I said, is universally fatal. So for the $12 that the rabies vaccine costs, I think it's a pretty good investment for your pet.
Speaking of cats who want to play with animals, I mean, is it possible for mice to have rabies and carry rabies?
Again, as technically, as it is a mammal, it certainly can carry rabies. But what we notice on very small mammals, and mice certainly amongst them, is that we don't see that as prevalent in the mice population. And that is probably due to the fact that a mouse is not likely to survive an attack by an animal which is infected with rabies. Whereas a larger animal, if it came into contact with a raccoon, another raccoon or a fox would likely survive and would propagate that virus. A mouse, it would not be injured. It would be killed. It would be swallowed. So,
I see. We'll go to Wendy calling from Springvale. Hi, Wendy. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. My question is for both of your guests. What is your take on the role that coyotes are playing in the spread of rabies? I've seen my fair share of coyotes here in the state of Maine, and I wonder if they're part of the same strain that the raccoon spread, or do they have a lesser virulent one and we don't see it that often?
I'm not aware of any different recognized strain for coyotes. Again, coyotes have been here since in Maine, since probably the beginning around 1950s or so. And just from looking at the CDC data over the years, I've noticed that there are occasionally some coyotes that do come back as positive and are involved in encounters with people, but much less so than other animals. In other parts of the country, I can recall in Texas, there was a case where coyotes were particularly a problem as far as rabies. This was many decades ago. But I have not seen anything here specific to coyotes. Again, if they're exposed to an animal which does have rabies, they are certainly vulnerable, and they will carry that and pass that along. But they're not one of the highest the numbers that we have as far as positives.
Wendy, thanks for your question. If you have a question for our guests about rabies, give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We are going to take a quick break, but first a word about tomorrow's program. It is time for the Month in Review. Our panel of editorial page editors returns to discuss what made Maine's headlines in July. So you can email your comments or questions ahead of time to talk@mainepublic.org. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Green Lion Gallery in downtown Bath, committed to making original art available to all. Shows, classes, and events at greenlionart.com. Roosevelt Campobello International Park, inviting you to explore the park's walking trails, beaches, and ocean headlands. FDR.net. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com.
Hello, this is Tamara Keith. Maine Public Radio and NPR News bring you real news, without the fluff. Every time you listen, you get headlines telling you about the most important events in the news, and long-form reports that give you the depth and breadth you need to truly understand what's happening. Add to this feature stories that introduce you to people, places, and ideas you didn't even know you'd want to know about until you hear them. That's Maine Public Radio and NPR News. It's why you listen, and it's why your financial support is so important. Please call 1-800-866-1475 or go to mainepublic.org now and have your donation counted towards the Super Thursday one-day membership drive.
Super Thursday is this Thursday, August 2nd.
On the next Speaking in Maine, we visit the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport.
Is the United States continued to prepare to lead in maintaining alliances and institutions and provide a framework in addressing longer-range problems?
Walter Slocum is a former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. He looks at the history and usefulness of diplomacy and force in the wars of the 20th century. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Monday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what is happening with rabies in Maine? Joining me, Dr. Michelle Walsh, state veterinarian, and Scott Lindsay, a wildlife biologist. You can join our conversation by giving us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We haven't gotten to sort of the nitty-gritty, Michelle, and I want to ask you, if I am bit by a rabid animal or a suspected rabid animal, or if my pet is, what is the first thing I ought to do and what is the second thing I ought to do?
Mm-hmm. So number one is bring the animal out inside or away from the attacking animal. I think that's fairly obvious to your listeners probably. But our first recommendation is actually to wash that wound, because if you think that we know that infected saliva is the route of exposure to the virus, so it's likely to be contaminating that wound, especially initially. So before it really gets to make a whole lot of headway into the body, we recommend that you wash it. Now, you should have gloves on while you do this, soap and water, and spend a good amount of time. We recommend 10 minutes in our main rabies management guidelines, and that's a CDC-endorsed parameter. So wash the wound and then seek veterinary care for that animal. So the veterinarian will do a full exam, most likely, and then evaluate the animal's rabies vaccination status. Even if the animal is up to date on rabies, we actually recommend that the veterinarian booster that vaccine to make sure that you provide maximum protection at that time, and then observe the animal at home for 45 days.
And you would wash the wound immediately before you take the animal to the veterinarian.
Correct.
Immediately wash that wound. Another good reason to have a good pair of rubber gloves under your sink.
Absolutely.
Many of them. Here's another one. And you said there are resources available.
So, right, we in the past probably 15 years in Maine have made a real effort to, first of all, coordinate all of the different agencies and the different parties who actually do respond to rabies calls. So Scott represents our Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. I represent the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. And then, of course, on the human health side, Maine CDC provides a lot of answers to questions about rabies. But I remember when I was in practice, and even as a pet owner and, you know, sometimes a livestock owner, I didn't often know who to ask at the state about all of the, you know, what resources are available, what am I required to do by law, et cetera. So we produced it's a pretty hefty manual called the Maine Rabies Management Guidelines, and there'll be a link to that on your website. But it really is written for the layperson to go and learn more about the disease, what to do if your animals are exposed. We do distribute it to veterinary clinics and to municipal offices. So ACOs certainly have a copy. Most of them drive around with one in their truck. The Warden Service employees all have a copy of it as well. And we have a Maine Rabies Working Group that we use to, we meet quarterly. And that's how we all talk to each other about and share statistics on rabies, unusual cases, case studies. Again, that's an interagency group, so not necessarily available to the public, but the products that we have from that group are all available to the public. And I really encourage people are really interested in this disease, and it's a really complicated and fascinating disease. So I really encourage them to take a look at the management guidelines if they're interested.
And we will provide a link to that on our webpage. We have an email from Henry. The host asks, what to do about a dog that, quote, spends its day running in the woods and comes back bearing evidence of a scuffle? You should be aware that it's against Maine law to have a dog at large running free and unsupervised. That doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, correct?
Just like the indoor cats are always indoors.
That's correct. And again, there are also dogs that are used for hunting purposes as well, and they're not directly on a lead. So there are times when animals, you know, are going to be outside of your view. So certainly you want to be aware if it does come back and appear as though it's been in a conflict with a wild animal.
We'll go to Jeff, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Oh, it's Kevin.
Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
Hi. I have an odd situation. It's two-part. There's a skunk that's been in my backyard, my driveway, and I've seen him. You know, it's daylight. He's walking. She's walking all around. She had one baby with her the other day. And, of course, my neighbor's dog got sprayed. But this skunk is out during the day. Is that showing symptoms of rabies? Isn't that one of the things you look for?
Okay. Jeff, yes, I do agree that if you see some species of wildlife out during the day when they are normally nocturnal animals, and a skunk would be one example of that, it is something that would be of interest and raise some concern. But just because you see a fox or a skunk out in the day, that does not mean that it has rabies. One thing I would point out is particularly this time of year, spring, summer is a time when wildlife is going to be having offspring. There are more mouths to feed. There is more likelihood that an animal, either the young of the year or the adults, are going to be out longer periods of time trying to procure food for the offspring. So particularly this time of year, I would not say it's unusual to have a fox, you know, playing in the field behind your house, seeing skunks or raccoons. Another thing that could potentially happen is the animal may have been kind of undercover, and maybe something happened. Maybe there was a local construction project or a local logging operation that kind of disrupted it, and all of a sudden its hideaway is no longer available to it, and it starts walking around and trying to look for another place. So yes, you want to just look for its behavior, see if it's something that indicates that it is not being normal behavior for a fox, and certainly signs of aggression towards you is another reason for concern. One other thing that I pointed out, another sign I would look for would include quills, porcupine quills, in the face of an animal. Most of the time, wildlife is going to know better than to attack a porcupine. Young of the year may be an exception to that, but they quickly learn. So you want to look out for that. Another thing you could look out for is evidence of self-mutilation in an animal. If it starts biting itself, biting its tail, that's certainly some cause for concern as well. And one other one I wanted to point out is an animal may also attack and show interest in inanimate objects that are not living, even toys that are out in the backyard. They may just jump on those and start attacking them. That's another thing which indicates probably some unusual behavior.
I just had one other comment about, if you're seeing these wild animals in your backyard for some period of time, what we do know about the rabies virus is by the time the animal is actually showing signs of rabies, it's about 3 to 7, or we usually sort of couch our give ourselves a little bit of leeway here. It's usually 3 to 10 days that they'll actually be aggressive and be trying to pass on the rabies virus itself. So, and then they die. So if you've seen this animal for a number of weeks in your backyard, it's very likely not to be rabid. It's just taken up. You clearly are very hospitable to this particular family of skunks.
Okay, Jeff, thanks. And we have a similar question from Tess. We have a charming family of foxes, a mom and 5 kits, who have made a home next door to our large backyard in South Portland. They hunt squirrels and mice in our yard and eat seeds that fall from the bird feeder. We love watching them, but should we be worried? Foxes aren't very scared of us when we go about on our property, and I worry that by the time we notice any strange behavior, they will be close enough to attack us. Have there been any cases of rabies in South Portland or the surrounding communities? And there have not, have there?
I am not aware of a specific case in South Portland, but it is certainly something that is quite possible. In years past, that it certainly has occurred. South Portland is not an exception to the range of rabid animals. So I would say, Tess, the best thing you can do is, it sounds like what you're already doing, and enjoying watching that wildlife. And if you want to get a closer look at it, don't go out and try to get a closer look at it by walking up close to it and trying to get better photos of it. Get a good pair of binoculars. They don't have to be expensive binoculars. Get a good camera and just enjoy watching them. Those young are just about weaned now, and they'll be starting to disperse a little later in August. So they may be hanging around that location of where that den was for another few weeks or so.
And generally speaking, Scott, you do not encourage people to do things to attract wildlife to their homes, right? Don't put out a deer lick, for example.
Yeah, I would say that is one of the real concerns that we do have, and I think it happens a lot more than we're aware of, but people naturally are going to befriend wildlife, and this is the case with raccoons, not so much skunk and porcupines, but fox as well. And some people really try to, in order to see them better, they will try to entice them in with some food. Sometimes they even come into homes. I really urge people to resist that. Do not do that. That is only going to cause that animal to be habituated towards you, and it is certainly going to increase your risk of exposure to that animal. And again, you don't want to transport animals around either. That's another reason why rabies can spread from one area to another. So don't leave wildlife in the wild. Enjoy it from your distance, but don't treat it as a domestic pet.
And I'm a bit surprised that you say do not bring it into your home. This happens?
It does, Jennifer. Yes, you'd be surprised. There are certainly some species that, if they are given the right incentives, they will make themselves at home in your home. And sometimes that's a very difficult habit to break. And often that means that animal realistically will have to be euthanized because it's going to continue to cause problems. Maybe at the neighbor's house or somewhere else. So it's definitely something that is not a benefit to the animal and puts the the person and any domestic animals at much higher risk.
Okay, I'm going to try to squeeze in another call or two, going to Laura in Denmark. Hi, Laura, go ahead.
Hi there, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I had, last year, we had a skunk kind of stroll into our yard. It was probably mid-August, and it was a young skunk, and our dogs attacked it and killed it. And I was concerned, and I'll be really honest, our dogs were older, so they were not quite current on their vaccines. We'd let them lapse a year because they just had had some issues with anaplasmosis and Lyme disease. So our vet actually kind of said, yeah, you know, they're old enough, probably not a good idea. But so we did have concerns, called the vet. We didn't see any signs of Che having been bitten or any blood. But oddly enough, within probably 2 to 3 weeks, Che collapsed on the Labor Day and was very, very ill and died on September 15th. And we really couldn't figure out what was going on with him. And it's always kind of nagged us. Could he have had rabies? But wouldn't he have been symptomatic in some sense if he had been?
Laura, I'm sorry to hear your story. Go ahead.
Yeah, Laura, I am also sorry to hear about your dog's fate there. It's unlikely that your dog actually died of rabies. First of all, you did examine your animal afterwards and didn't find any evidence of a bite. If your dog's had a robust history of rabies vaccination, it's likely your dog would have been protected. Also, as you suggested yourself, it's very likely that the dog would have showed signs of rabies, there is usually an aggressive phase. Even if there is an aggressive phase, very abnormal behavior, retreating from people, or like we've talked about before, sort of charging people and just acting really strange would be much more in line with rabies versus a collapse.
All right. Well, Laura, thank you for your call. And that is going to be the last call for the hour. Such an interesting topic. We've mentioned a lot of resources on the air today. Those will be posted on the Maine Calling website. So we encourage you to go there if you have questions that have not been answered during this hour. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Michelle Walsh, the state veterinarian with the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation and Forestry, and Scott Lindsay, regional wildlife biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. John Keimel ran the board today. Today's program will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, analyzing the news of the past month. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.